Thank you for joining us today on this episode of The Sword and Trowel. Today, Graham is away from Cape Coral, but we have in town Mark Coppinger. Mark is here teaching a course for us in the Institute of Public Theology. If you'd like more information on the Institute, then please contact us at Founders. We'd be glad to tell you more. Dr. Coppinger and I talk about the state of the Southern Baptist Convention and what's going on. And he was involved very heavily in the conservative resurgence, so he's seen things from a long time point of view, has a lot of wisdom, a lot of insight, and gives us some reason to be hopeful as we move into the upcoming convention in Indianapolis. So listen in today, and if you like what you hear, please share it and help others to know about this conversation. Welcome to The Sword and Trowel. The Sword and Trowel is a podcast of Founders Ministries, and Founders exists for the recovery of the gospel and the reformation of local churches. And I'm Tom Askell, and I am here with Mark Coppinger. Dr. Coppinger, welcome to The Sword and Trowel.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Glad to have you actually on the set today. You're here in Cape Coral teaching for the Institute of Public Theology, and this has just been day one you've just completed, right?
Right.
And it's Logic and Rhetoric.
Right. Yeah. And the subtitle is Reasoning and Persuading.
Yeah, very good. Very good. I got to sit on about an hour of your lectures today and really benefited from that. So thanks a lot for giving yourself to this. What we wanted to do today is to talk about what's going on in the SBC. You're a lifer, right, in the SBC.
So from the cradle role, as
yeah,
they say.
Me too. And as I recall, I think your dad was a pastor. Is that correct? Or a Southern Baptist minister?
Boy, my dad, he's a graduate of Southern, and he was a pastor. And then he was the BCM director, I think, at Auburn in Kentucky. And then he was a chaplain in World War II. And he taught at Cumberland, used to be a Baptist school, Lebanon, Tennessee. He taught at Cumberland, Carson Newman, Belmont, and Ouachita.
Okay.
And he was interim and pastor in Pennington Gap of Virginia and Newport, Tennessee. So, yeah.
Wow. And that's great. And then Sharon, your wife's dad, was also.
He was the pastor of a big North Little Rock church, president of the convention, chairman of the board at Ouachita, state exec in Missouri. Mm-hmm. And when he died early of leukemia, they named the state mission offering after Reuben South.
That. Yeah. And he was my aunt and uncle's pastor in Arkansas.
Park Hill.
Yeah, in Park Hill. That's right. Yeah.
I know that.
So I remember hearing about Reuben South.
He was an amazing guy. And by the way, he was a
B-17
bombardier over Germany in World War II
and
flew many missions over there. So
he's a
tough guy. My dad was just a chaplain in South Pacific.
Well, nobody can doubt your SBC bona fides. You've stayed through thick and thin. You've seen things through the conservative resurgence. I remember, I don't know that we met, but I knew of you at Southwestern because we were at Southwestern at the same time. And we had a couple of classes together. I don't remember what they were, but I remember that the professors always seemed to be a little more circumspect whenever you were in the class. And I kept thinking, who is this guy? And I finally found out that you had done a PhD in philosophy at Vanderbilt. Is that right?
Correct.
And had taught at Vandy. Is that right?
Yes.
And maybe somewhere else before you came to Southwestern?
At Wheaton for 6 years.
You taught at Wheaton?
Wheaton College,
okay. So here's this professor of philosophy coming to do an MDiv at Southwestern during some of the heated days of the conservative resurgence.
Exciting times. And by the way, some of the guys at Wheaton said, oh, you've already got a PhD. What are you going to, selling the house and moving down? Yeah, but I don't have it in ministry or preaching. And I was drinking out of a fire hose. Mm. I mean, Greek and Hebrew and preaching all that. It was a great experience.
Yeah. Well, I remember being grateful that you were there because, again, the professors acted a little better.
I didn't know that. Okay.
They did. They definitely did. When you weren't there, it was not as easy. So,
oh, that's funny.
No. I was glad to know of you and then get to know you through the years and appreciate so much your friendship and just admire how faithful you've been so long in a lot of different circumstances. You've seen the good, the bad, the kind of underbelly of the SBC, and you're still pro SBC.
Oh yeah, I love it, and I'm in for its family.
Yeah,
and I'd say I showed a clip of you from the 2019 convention in Birmingham to the class today on rhetoric and how you took to the mic and said, "This CRTI stuff, you don't know what you're getting into." And it was a very courageous thing, and you spoke so eloquently. So I'll brag on you. Thank God for you.
Well, that's kind of you. Well, man, if you had to give a State of the SBC Union address, what would be some of your main points?
Well, I'm very encouraged by it. I mean, it's a different thing, but there is an element of comparison between the SBC and our nation that things were pushed or have been pushed in a certain way. And now I think people are saying, I think, you know, we're still a nation, but I think something needs to be tweaked. And I got that sense. I tell you, that vote on the bylaw about women, you know, the law amendment, I was surprised. I mean, I was a little surprised that they drew the line on women pastors the day before.
Yeah.
But when they got that 2/3 vote, and I remember some of the big leaders in recent years were standing, you could tell they weren't enjoying this.
Mm-hmm.
And we just went right ahead and did it. And it gave me a little bit of a feel from 1985 in Dallas and some of those early days in conservative resurgence, where a lot of the people who were big shots were saying, no, it's not worth it. You know, don't come on. You're being divisive. And we showed up and we voted, and it's like, wow, did that really happen? And so I think the ground is still good. Mm-hmm. And there was a little bump there, and it's like, whoa, I think we're coming back.
Yeah, well, I was encouraged by that too. And when you factor in how it came to be, because Mike Law made that motion the year before it got referred to the executive committee. He was invited to speak to it, to the executive committee. They kind of changed that on him as it led up to it, and they only gave him a couple of minutes when he was supposed to have longer. And then the executive committee didn't want to bring it out.
Yeah,
they weren't going to bring it out. And so much pressure was put on them. Now, I don't know if it's ever happened before. I can't recall it. But they brought it out with saying, we don't want you to vote for this positively, but we're going to bring it out, let you vote. And so you had all that going against it, and we still voted with a supermajority to do it. So that is a very encouraging thing.
And it was very heartening to me.
Yeah, yeah. So the convention coming up in Indianapolis in June of this year, we have to vote on it again.
Correct.
So it has to be affirmed 2 years in a row.
Yeah.
To change the bylaws. Yeah. And there's been some efforts to overturn that or to stop it, to slow it down. And James Merritt made the motion to have a cooperation group study, you know, what it means to cooperate in the SBC. And so Bart Barber appointed a committee of people. And on that committee are some folks who very outspokenly voted against the law amendment who have women pastors in their churches. So I don't know how that's going to come out.
Yeah, I just, you know, I looked at that, and I do think that they were against it, but they were putting it in a broader thing. Like, we're concerned that, you know, let me put this in context. I was talking to Herschel Hobbs years ago, writing a little piece for a Baptist theologian's book, and he was talking about an august Atlanta pastor or some grand fellow back in the 30s or whatever. And anyway, he was sitting on the platform, maybe in a, you know, a very fancy tuxedo or something, and things were popping at the microphones. And anyway, he said, one guy leaned to the other and said, this is not seemly, this is not appropriate, you know, tacky. And he said, oh, if you're going to let the little dogs hunt, you got to let them bark. And, you know, so arrogant, you know. But in a sense, like, okay, we little dogs barked. And so they were kind of huffing and puffing and saying, well, we you guys got ahead of your skis there. You don't know where this is leading. And let us take care and show you how to be. And so they said the little dogs barked. And now let's help. But instead of just saying straight on, we made a big mistake here with the deal. We're going to put it. Now, I'm reminded of when we had the two votes back in the 90s on churches affirming homosexuality. Mm-hmm. There were two in North Carolina. And so we did the 2-year vote. First one, I think, maybe Indy, second Houston. And so we don't do that very often. We underlined that. Now they're saying, oh, yeah, and you do that this year, then what next are you going to do? I mean, we basically allow for just war or something, so now if they're a pacifist, we throw that church out. So anyway, I'm thinking, no, the answer is quite simple. We're not just going to run crazy with this thing. It's just like if something becomes so grievous, so outstanding, we may do a third one sometime 5 or 6 years from now, but don't say. See, there was a little bit of this with the gay thing. They were saying, oh, yeah, you'll do that this year. Then the next year, if there's social drinking at the Sunday school party, and then the next thing you know, if you have social dancing or whatever, you know. And they were saying that slippery slope's going. But the slippery slope could go the other way.
That's right.
And you could say, okay, we excuse that this time. Then what are you going to excuse? Transgender affirming, you know, deacon? I mean, what? Mm-hmm. Where are you going to go that way? So they're kind of playing the slippery slope game. And I would say, you know, cool your jets. We know what we're doing, and we want to underline this one. Because otherwise, it's just the pleasure of the convention. Yeah, we did that last year, but hey, it's no big deal. It's not this year. We can let them in this year. This is our way to put a strong exclamation mark or to highlight in, you know, some color. And we don't do that lightly. And it takes 2 years. So, like, take a deep breath. This is a good thing.
I just
wonder that cluster at the microphone, if that was that impressive to people, including James, it's like, oh, I see. So that's where you guys have been. So I'm not worried about that so much.
Good. Well, I hope that gets whatever recommendation. I'm not counting on any good recommendation coming out from it, you know. Yeah. So I hope that there will, if it's a bad recommendation, that there will be a minority report from guys on the committee who say, no, we're not going that way.
Thank you for joining us today for this conversation on the Sword and the Trowel. I wanted to make you aware and give you some more details on the regional conference that we are going to be having coming up here this July. That's July 26th and 27th, and it is the conference on family life in the negative world. Pastor Tom Askell, Dr. Joel Beakey, and myself will all be there speaking for that conference. It's going to be a wonderful time. You can go to founders.org/family life in order to register for that conference. It's just a shorter conference, a regional conference. It's just 2 days, but it's going to be a wonderful time of fellowship and thinking about what God has to say to us when it comes to how we are to live in families, be family members, and raise our families in an increasingly hostile world.
One of the things that I think helped galvanize this reaction was in Anaheim when we had the chairwoman of the Credentials Committee basically say, but we don't know what a pastor is.
Yeah.
You know, we can't decide this because we don't know what a pastor is. And I know there are a lot of guys that I've talked to that said, man, if we don't know what a pastor is, we're in bigger trouble than we knew we were before. Yeah. So hopefully there will be a course correction that we began to see last year. And of course, there's four different guys now that have been nominated to be president of the SBC. And I'm scheduled to interview the four of them and have a little panel. I think it's, I forget what day that is, March 26th, I think it is. But we'll make note of that and get that information out to you. And, you know, there's not a liberal in the bunch. I mean, we're past that. So you can't look at any of them and say, oh, yeah, this guy's a liberal. But they do see things differently in terms of what's going on in the convention and how the convention needs to respond to the day that we're living in now. Well, beyond the women pastor thing, one of the big issues that we've been grappling with the last several years is sex abuse. And I mean, sex abuse is horrific.
Right.
The cover up of sex abuse is horrific. I don't know any Southern Baptist anywhere. I don't know any Christian anywhere who wouldn't agree with that. But the way that this has been marshaled forth in the convention and how it has, the shape that it's taken, has resulted in some really serious consequences. Challenges to our polity, financial. I think it's like $10 million or so that's
I've
been
lost
spent.
The count. I don't. I know the guide. What was a guidepost? That was like $1.7 million. But then the settlement with the lady who used to work at Lifeway and stuff. I think that was $1 million.
That's
just
right.
Million here, million there. Before long, you got something going. You know.
Yeah. So I mean, you've done some writing on this, and I've seen. You know, you did this a statistical analysis actually. Yeah. If you take all of the original, was it 700 cases supposedly that the San Antonio Express and Houston Chronicle came up with, and these were public records, so it's not like this is covered up anywhere. And then when they filtered it down, it wasn't 700 Southern Baptists. They weren't all Southern Baptists.
Yeah, it was actually 700 victims, so to speak.
Is that what
it was?
It was
only 218, I think, original convictees.
Perpetrators,
and then they did a little more research, and I think they came up with 263, and then that's over a 20-year period. That's from 2000 on up. Well, I mean, forgive me, I used to be the public relations guy for the executive committee, and I did it sincerely. I mean, it wasn't like I was just a hired flack or something that I thought, look, we're honorable. They're calling us all kinds of names, rednecks, you know, bibliolatrists, you name it. And I said, no, I'm going to stand up for the honor. And I guess my impulse is like, are you saying that out of the 28 million different Southern Baptists we've had, because we maybe started with 15. I can't remember the count. Yeah. And we add about 500,000, 400,000 a year, and we lose some, but cumulative. And to get 263 out, I mean, what's the percentage? Out of 28 million, in a sense, I'm surprised it wasn't more. I mean, I figured at a certain point it'd be a certain number of mega churches that you'd have one case. And so anyway, I said, let's cool our jets a bit here. Of course, it's terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But it strikes me that we are, and I've just written a piece, actually, about crying fire in a crowded theater.
Mm.
And I just think we panicked, and all of a sudden, and then we're giving up our legal counsel and turning to the totally disinterested adepts in the outside world. I say that sarcastically. And so I've written a piece, and I came up with a couple of other different things that I for my book, If Christianity is So Good, Why Are Christians So Bad? I did for Christian Focus.
Yeah.
I studied, I think it was six dioceses in Pennsylvania, and they had something like 2,000 priests, and 300 priests, I mean clergy, were found out by the grand jury and charged. Whereas these aren't priests. This is everything. One of them was a miner. You've got plumber, a postman, people who are volunteers here and there. Somebody's a janitor or, you know, I guess somebody could be a leaf trip driver for seniors. I mean, anything. Yeah. And it struck me it was so small. Well, I recently found that 28 million is roughly the population of Texas today. Mm. And they have over 100,000 registered sex offenders in Texas. And then out of those priests, 2,000 out of those priests in those dioceses, 300 priests. And then I look at ours, and there's a guy who's done some wonderful work. He used to work for Buckner International, which was affiliated with the Texas Convention. Mm-hmm. And he's been a real estate developer, and he's an accountant. And he helped expose the Ponzi scheme that the Arizona Foundation was running.
Yeah.
And in fact, he's credited in the Wall Street Journal about that time of being one of the players to help spring this thing. You know, his name's Alan Jordan. And he did a case-by-case analysis of this. And he found that, he says, there's 72 really serious kind of credible cases. And you have other cases where a guy was incidentally associated with a church. Or some of them weren't even in Southern Baptist churches. And so he just says, hey, it's even more extreme than we thought, our reaction. Yeah. So I'm just saying, hey, let's re-examine. What have we done? But that's part of my OPR thing, but I love it. I mean, I love the convention.
Yeah, yeah. And I've thought about this as well, because even in the reporting, all but like 17 of them had been adjudicated in the legal system.
Yeah, you know? So, it's not like they're just hanging out there, and that's how it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be at the local church and the local authorities, and the guy served, and what's that? The system has worked as well as you would expect it to work, but now all of a sudden we're the police force at the top level, and I think that's not how we were appointed.
So what do you think's going on with that? Why do you think we were so susceptible to be played that way?
You know, I just did a piece, I'm not sure if it'll come out, but it was the thing about crying fire in a crowded theater, and I said we are crowded with a number of things. I mean, part of it is just goodwill and horror, but part of it was, I think there were people that had tricky motives that this is a way to get even with the executive committee for questioning the ERLC and playing with the election coming up. Yeah. I think there were, I think now you have motives of like covering yourself. If you've gotten way out there, then you got to keep it exciting, or you look like you overreacted. A variety of things. I think we were overcrowded with trust in newspapers, in the wisdom of some of our leaders, and down through the line. So I just think, like you say, I go back to a case when it was like early 1900s, and it was in a church in Birmingham, and Booker T. Washington was speaking, I think, to the National Baptists, and pardon me for the cough. And anyway, they crowded in the church, and near the end, somebody was arguing with another guy about a seat, and I think he stepped on his foot, and they started to do a little tussle, and a lady yelled, "There's a fight!" And people heard fire.
Uh-huh.
And so they started moving to the exits with a hubbub, and another guy went to the mic and said, "Quiet, get quiet!" And they heard fire, and they trampled, and 115 Baptists died that day. They just got trampled. And I just think you just throw all this stuff out. I call it special pleading, where you just present one side. There's no moderating thing, like, let's relax a little bit. And so it's been a stampede, and it's injured our polity. But I think some are becoming a little more sober. And there were some of the cases, like the guidepost report. Wait, you're saying that this started and it went well into the 30s, and that doesn't quite sound as much like a victim. And then there, so anyway, I think I don't think it's aging well.
Right, I agree with that. And I don't know that we're going to get where we need to get without strong leadership that is willing to call for the kind of accountability that all of us thought we had. You know, trustee boards have a job to do, and and I'm not sure that our trustees have been well trained in how to do their jobs, and so that might be an area that we would need to look at.
I think trustees often see themselves more as staff than trustees. You know, they're just like, hey, if you know, you're pulling, you're going right along with the leadership, and Yes, sir. And I think that's not exactly what they are.
Yeah, I agree.
More than staff.
You know? Exactly. And transparency. There's just going to, I don't know any way forward. And I know everybody's nervous about that, but I don't know any way forward without just turning on the lights and saying, no, look, this is what's going on. This is what has happened. And where there's things that we need to gulp about and apologize for, let's do it. But it's probably not as bad as some of the stories that are circulating because we just don't know. So somehow we're going to have that as well. And I hope that we will get some leaders that will begin to say, okay, we get this. Because the bleeding of good churches out of the convention over the last several years, it's been sad to me.
I compare it sometimes to the United Way, that let's just say in Nashville you might have Dollar General store headquarters and you have Hospital Corporation of America, whatever. They're all in the United Way, and it turns out that HCA, there was some secretary who did something bad, and now we're going to charge Dollar General Store for what? I mean, we're more like the United Way, where we're a volunteer sort of thing. So, yeah, I hope so. And transparency, I have to say, I was raised in RAs, where I'm reading about Bill Wallace of China and, you know, Lottie and the like, and you have people who are going and dying places or circuit riding or whatever and just putting it out there. And I'm more concerned than I've ever been that we're really becoming slick and we're becoming more like business oriented, and you have non-disclosure this, and you have golden parachutes and all this kind of stuff. And like, boy, where's that RA dream I had of just putting it out there and letting the people know? And that, I would say, it has to do with benefit packages and so forth and so on. It's like, what are you anxious about? Well, that's not good business practice and stuff. Well, we're not a business. You know, we're a ministry, and that's just one of my things. But I love the transparency thing.
Well, I think it's got to happen, because if Southern Baptists believe in anything, we believe in missions. We want to get the gospel around the world. And I remember as a younger pastor, it was eye-opening to me once I finally figured out the whole formula thing, you know, what was going on whenever you put a dollar in the plate of your church. And if your church sends 10 cents of that dollar to the state convention keeps 60 cents and sends 40 cents. And, you know, you start thinking, wait a minute. This is not, and all of the promotion had International Mission Board pictures from around the world. And that's what we thought we were supporting. And we were, but it just needed to be more transparent. And once that happened, states started kind of getting on board with doing things better. And we just need that. So God willing, going forward, we'll see some of that.
I hope so. And I just think the base is firm enough that people of goodwill, if they'll get in the vans and so forth and show up as they did in the old days, that people will be surprised. I do use this word I've used before, ingratiationism. And I think that we have a number of people who are saying, if we just will, I mean, we've heard the word pronoun courtesy, and like the world is watching. And I think that some of us think of us as a manager, we're managing and we're marketing and the like. And I'm losing more track of just the sheer power of truth and the word from the pulpit. And when I was the PR guy, we had a clipping service, and we had all this press covering, and we never really gave away the store. We just said, just be sure you get it right. So, you know, in the early days, well, this cannibalism, the guy said after church, let's go home, sister, go to bed. And like, well, no, it was his wife. They're not, I mean, incest or cannibalism. We're eating the body of Christ. No. So on those things, we would say, this is who we are. you don't like us, but at least you know who we are. But we weren't trying to ingratiate or change mm-hmm. things. Now I'm worried that we're trying a little bit too hard to be Madison Avenue or be well thought of as, you know, we don't want to turn anybody off. If we do that, that'll turn them off. And pretty soon you turn page out of the scripture. We can't touch that with a stick. Can't touch mm-hmm. that. And I just want to say we're basically regular guy, Bible people. And let's be that and let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Sword and the Trowel today. If this episode has been helpful to you, or if any of the resources that Founders Ministries puts out is helpful, and there are many resources if you go to founders.org, we'd love for you to come alongside us to support us in our ministry and in our endeavors. The Lord's been kind to us and faithful to us and in allowing us to do so many things, from our publishing to our podcasts to our theological journals and conferences and many other things. But if the Lord is calling you to come alongside us and support us in this, we'd ask you to go to founders.org and you can go to the Give tab there and support us financially. We thank the Lord for your gift.
You know, the Southern Baptist Convention, it matters. I've often said to our folks and others, look, it's not that big a deal, but it really matters. So
I like that way to put it.
If our church, our church, by God's grace, will continue to do what we're called to do, if the Southern Baptist Convention exists or not, you know, because that's not our primary identity.
Yeah, that's right.
However, the Southern Baptist Convention matters because it is the largest Protestant denomination in America, and it does have resources and it does have opportunities to do things collectively as congregational churches that you couldn't do individually. And one of the things that's happened to me, Mark, over the last, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years or so, is I've become convinced. I was slow. It took a long time, and I was really a skeptic early on. But I've become convinced that there are larger forces at play that want to sway the SBC. They want to take it over. They want to. They don't care about religion. They don't care one way or the other. They have issues that they're concerned about culturally, politically, and financially, that if they can do this and get the SBC to not take a stand, or maybe to open up themselves to taking a stand in some other areas, that they can get their agenda furthered. And I've seen the evidence now, and there's a book coming out by Meg Basham, and she connects the dots on this, that I believe if the average Southern Baptist deacon sitting in our churches saw this, would be incensed. And would not stand for it. And sadly, I think it's we've just had leaders that some of them may have played along with it intentionally, but I think probably more of them have just kind of ignorantly been led astray. Had carrots stuck in front of them that chased after. So we shouldn't be naive to that kind of reality.
I agree. I mean, I do think the ERLC and Russ Moore played a role in. We're just waking up to who he is and some of the leadership and how he connects up. I did see a Babylon Bee the other day where David French wrote this letter and says, I can't believe people used to take me seriously or something like this. But there is this woke, kind of cool dude sort of thing going, and it is very sympathetic to some things that are happening in the culture. And they'll say, oh, you shouldn't think about, you know, about all this stuff. No, they're hip deep in broader political things and wanting to turn that sort of thing. So, you would say, get off your high horse for one thing, because you are really about an agenda. I think ERLC played a major role in that. I just worry that people are more trusting than they need to be. I just hope that we're saying, like, this isn't who we are. I hate to be this way. I'm not typically really optimistic, but I'm optimistic.
That's great. That's encouraging.
I'm smelling a little bit. I'm sniffing some good stuff from 1985. But I may be Pollyanna.
Yeah. Were you there in Dallas in 1985?
Yes, I was. I was sitting on the floor in Dallas. And
wasn't that a zoo?
Yeah. Wow. I remember I had a deacon who said, we were heading down to Dallas, and he says, oh, I feel like the Scotsman who says, oh, I got to go to Glasgow this weekend and get drunk, and boy, do I dread it. And so, you know, he was going like, oh, mercy. And it was like, oh, mercy, but still, mercy.
Yeah.
What a deal.
Sat behind Bill Sherman and Cecil Sherman. And they were outspoken on the other side. And when some of those votes went the wrong way for them, they were very upset. And It was a decisive moment. And, yeah. W.A. Crizzle's sermon at the pastor's conference was so powerful. Yeah. So, yeah, I hopefully we're seeing some of that. Mm-hmm. And as a pastor, you know, I mean, I've got plenty to do trying to shepherd the flock here. Yeah. And the guys that I talk to are pastoring churches feel the exact same way. And yet, my desire and what I've tried to say to guys is, look, mm-hmm. if you're going to stay in the convention, then be good Southern Baptist. You know, work for the good. Don't just be passive and sit by and let things go. So what would your counsel be to Southern Baptist pastors? We got a lot of pastors that listen in to the Sword and Trowel. Yeah. So what would you say to them about the upcoming convention and just about the whole idea of, okay, you know, what's involved? Why should we care? Why should we stay in?
Yeah, boy. Well, for one thing, I mean, I guess do as you will, but I think it's wonderful to be engaged. I mean, we were leprous in the early going. Yeah. I remember people, some professors were, you know, marginalized in the seminaries, and they were called all kinds of names in the state papers. When we went to the Indiana Convention, the Indiana Baptist was the only one out of 30 mm-hmm. plus papers mm-hmm. that was saying we're on board, and yet you just do what's right. We saw the Band of Brothers thing from Henry V today, and it's like, look, we're outnumbered 5-1 here in France. But, you know, I would not be, I pity those guys a bit in England today because they should hold their manhoods cheap. So I think it's definitely worth advancing. I taught at Wheaton for 7 years, full time. And there were a lot of missionaries going out. They were doing deputation, and they might have to, like, 6 churches, and they have to keep the plate spinning. And then I'm just sitting there like, we've got this cooperative program with support for missionaries, and they have homes, and they have cars, and they have the, you know, the furloughs and all that. And it's just part of our giving. And I love that so much, and I believe in that. And the great good, I mean, I read state papers and stuff, and the great good that's being done in so many places. But we've got to get the grassroots people there. Yeah. And so I'd say turn out for Indianapolis and be decisive. Some of these guys were mill workers in Texas, and they would drive down in a van from Oklahoma and maybe spend the night in some little scratchy place mm-hmm. or in the van mm-hmm. and vote for the president and get back so they didn't lose some money. And I'm thinking that's what turned it around.
Yeah.
If we just left it to – I mean, it used to be the case, I think they say, that – we would say to liberals, we'll call you Christians if you call us scholars, you know. Well, I think now we're more like, we'll call you cool and sensitive stuff and if you'll call us cool.
Yeah.
And so we want to be that way. And I'm thinking, don't go out of your way to be awkward, but we are awkward when we stand for the word of God. And so embrace that. I think of this word, hope and change. And I think some of the guys, you know, we heard that in another area. And I think some of these young guys are just thinking, we got to have some hope and change. We're the future of tomorrow. And, you know, it's so exciting. And I'm thinking, no, I think of From Other Brother, Where Art Thou, where you got the people in white, and they're going through the woods and go down to the river to pray, study about the good old ways. Mm. And I think we need to go down to the river and pray again.
Amen. Amen. Well, I agree with you wholeheartedly. And what we are facing and the troubles we have, well, they'll all be solved by God coming down in power and his people being humbled again. And if the Lord would be so gracious to us to do that, that would be marvelous. And wouldn't it be wonderful to see the Southern Baptist Convention be a great force for great good, as it has been and is in some ways now, but it could be so much better.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah, it would.
Well, you preach, I'll turn the pages. I love that. That sounds great.
Well, Dr. Coppinger, thank you so much for joining me today. And it's always good to have you here in town and with your lovely wife. We just appreciate so much your stewardship of all that God's entrusted to you, and look forward to seeing how he will lead you in the future.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us today on the Sword and Trowel. If we can do anything to serve you, please don't hesitate to reach out. It would be our joy to do so. Also want to thank those Founders Alliance members that support us regularly and pray for us, enabling us to do what we do here at Founders.